This podcast is brought to you by ClearBridge Investments. Meet an evolving economy confidently with ClearBridge Active Equities, the foundation of a resilient portfolio. ClearBridge, a Franklin Templeton company. Go to clearbridge.com to learn more.
Please stay tuned for important disclosure information at the conclusion of this episode.
Welcome to The Long View. I'm Jeff Patak, Global Director of Manager Research for Morningstar Research Services.
And I'm Christine Benz, Director of Personal Finance for Morningstar.
Our guest in this week's episode of The Long View is none other than Josh Brown, CEO of Ritholtz Wealth Management. Josh's story is unique and inspiring. He began his career as a broker, but grew disillusioned with the industry's skewed incentives and practices, eventually pursuing a career as an independent registered investment advisor. Along the way, Josh managed to author an acclaimed book, Backstage Wall Street, and build an enormous following around his blog, The Reform Broker, as well as his Twitter handle, @ReformBroker. Now he oversees Ritholtz's day-to-day operations in addition to his other duties, which include serving as a regular contributor on CNBC, as a member of the fintech firm Brightscope's advisory board, and most recently as a technical advisor on the Showtime hedge fund drama Billions. If it seems like Josh is everywhere, that's not far from the truth. Today, he's here as our guest, and we're very pleased to have him. Josh, welcome to The Long View.
Thank you so much for having me, guys.
Thank you so much for doing this.
It's my pleasure. Christine, you're like a legend. I've been reading your stuff since forever. I'm really excited.
So, Josh, some of our listeners, I think, are familiar with your background, but not all of them are. Your blog, as I mentioned, is called The Reform Broker. There's a story there, a snippet of which I shared. But can you briefly describe sort of how you came to where you are today? And I know that part of your story is sort of taking control of your own narrative and breaking away. So can you maybe give a little bit of background on yourself and how you came to be CEO of Ritholtz Wealth Management?
I'll give you the abridged version, and then Great. If I leave anything out, you can ask me. So I spent about 10 years as a retail broker. I was happy in the beginning because it was a good business, and I was learning about the markets, and I fell in love with stocks, and I just loved talking to clients and coming up with investment ideas. And it was kind of like, I was young. I hadn't had experience doing anything else. So I thought what I was doing was helpful. And I guess this would apply to a lot of people. In 2008, 2009, in that period, I looked back and I realized a lot of the quote-unquote advice I had been giving people was not really what they needed. And I had a little bit of like a personal crisis because I was a commissioned broker. So if you're not doing transactions, you're not getting paid. And I had felt very strongly that what was going on was a financial catastrophe. There was really no precedent for it. And I had felt really strongly that the best thing I could do for clients would be nothing. So they had their mutual funds, they had their stocks, but I really didn't feel that it was in their best interest for me to be coming up with trades for them to do. And unfortunately, that led to not making any money for a year, and literally going through pay periods where I was just talking to people on the phone, holding their hands, taking meetings, but not making money. And, you know, my wife kind of said something that where a light bulb went off my head. She said, if you're doing something where the only way to make money would be to do the wrong thing, meaning start trading people's accounts during a financial crisis, then you're probably in the wrong business. And that kind of forced me to look at what else was out there. And I discovered that, that there was a better way forward, which was financial advice as opposed to brokerage and selling trades and transactions. So that's where the reformed broker moniker came from. And at the same time I was having this self-discovery, the moment I started writing the blog, and the blog was not like, look how smart I am. It was really just a place for me to vent. And the compliance officer, he was like, look, I really don't want you to do it, but look what, Lehman Brothers is out of business and Madoff and the world is coming to an end anyway, so do whatever you want. It was kind of like, he was like, look, just don't do anything that breaks a FINRA guideline about, talking about track records and whatever. But, if you want to say what you're saying, I don't even know if we're going to be working here in 3 months anyway. So that's kind of the origin story. And he was right, by the way. But the blog led to meeting Barry Ritholtz at a financial blogger conference, I guess you would call it, out in San Diego. And Barry at that time had an interesting thing going on where he was the most famous market pundit in the world. He had written Bailout Nation, which was a bestseller about the crisis. He had been screaming that a crisis was coming for years, and he ended up being right. But he was never a financial advisor. Like Barry never, you know, dealt directly with clients. He always was a chief strategist. So he would tell other financial advisors what to do. And then, of course, they wouldn't listen. So he was basically like, look, I have all these people that want me to help them and manage money for them, but it's not what I do. So we came up with the idea to join forces in 2011, and it worked immediately. So that led to us eventually forming our own firm in September 2013. So we're almost 6 years old, and it's really been a rocket ship.
That ambivalence you felt about being in a commission-based model is ambivalence that I would imagine some brokers, let's call them, still feel today. And so if they're at the same point you were a few years ago when you were having to make some serious decisions about your future, what advice would you give them? I know that you've probably given that advice on your blog and elsewhere before, but maybe for the benefit of our listeners, what would that advice sound like?
It's, you know, it's tough because, well, first of all, I think the whole industry has changed anyway. Like, I think there are still people who work for a quote unquote brokerage firm. But if you actually look at how they're managing money, most of it is in an advisory capacity. Like, there are right. very few people with big practices of buying and selling stocks or buying A share mutual funds. Like, I think that's kind of going away anyway, whether or not, you know, the best interest regulation or fiduciary rule or like, I just think the industry has been moving that direction for a long time anyway. But then you've got this whole group of people who make a lot of their living selling products. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes they're hybrids and they've got an advisory side of their business. And then every once in a while, they sell somebody shares in a non-traded REIT or they sell someone an annuity. And it's a lot of money. You get paid 8%, 10%. It's, you know, this is these people's livelihood. And then the other thing is, especially at the larger firms, I think there's just this idea that, you know, they've been doing something the same way for so long that they're not looking for a change. They're not looking for advice. You know, they're in their 50s and they just want to run out the clock doing what they've been doing. So I don't really try to advise people who haven't figured it out at this point. Like if they haven't figured it out by now, it's because they don't want to. And that's okay. I'm nobody to judge. But I think if you look at where all the asset flows are going in the industry, they're clearly going into the RIA channel. It is the only game in town. And so you don't have to take my advice or anyone else's advice. You could do it what you want. But if you really want to be successful in 2019 and beyond, I think you have to be an advisor to your client and minimize any potential conflict to the greatest extent that you can.
So, Josh, there are still millions of investors and savers being served by the traditional wirehouse brokerage system that you broke away from. Would you say it's failing them?
No, I wouldn't for the reason that I just mentioned, which is that a lot of the when Morgan Stanley reports earnings every quarter, one of the data points that Gorman reveals is how much of the advisory business is on a fee basis as opposed to on a transaction basis. And the fee basis within these firms keeps growing. And that'll continue until the point where these firms are brokerages in name only and they really look more like gigantic RIAs. Mm-hmm. Now, there are some notable differences. One of the biggest revenue generators at traditional Wall Street wirehouse firms is lending. And it's brilliant. You think about this idea. You have a client who's got a $3 million account with you. Let's say you're billing 1% on that. Okay, so you're making some money. Now the firm says, hey, you have an opportunity here. You've got this client, Bob Smith, and Bob probably could use a loan. Maybe he's got credit card debt or maybe he wants to buy a vacation home. He doesn't have to sell his portfolio out. He can keep his whole portfolio intact and we can attach a loan to that account. It's a non-underwritten loan. So it's really, really fast. We can arrange it within 48 hours and he could borrow a different amount on his stocks than he can on his bonds. But overall, he can take out $500,000 right this minute. He could buy a boat. The only thing he can't do is buy more securities because it's not a margin loan. So the beauty of that is you're getting another revenue stream on the same pool of assets. So you're billing to manage the $3 million account, and then you're getting a point or whatever you're getting on the loan of $500,000. It's the same amount of money. It's the same client. You didn't have to do any other extra work. And you didn't even have to sell out the portfolio, so you can keep billing on the whole thing. And the last part of that is it makes the money very sticky. We talk to clients all the time, and they have a portfolio, they're not thrilled with the performance or they're not thrilled with the guy or gal who's managing the money, but like, you know, I have $1 million in debt attached to the portfolio. I can't do anything. Can't move it. I don't want to have to refinance the debt. So it makes those assets really sticky. So that is a huge moneymaker on the street right now. The difference between that and how a traditional RIA is managing money, we have clients that need loans too. We just can't get paid on them. Like, we can arrange them. We can set them up. We can help them collateralize their portfolio assets. But two very crucial differences. Number one, we never recommend it. Like, I don't think true financial advice is telling someone to take on more debt just in general. And number two, if we do arrange it, it's as a service, and we can't be compensated either by the lender or by the client or whatever. So I think the lending business is a key distinction between a fee-based account at a wirehouse and a fee-based account at a traditional RIA. And it'll probably stay that way for a long time.
So for a client that maybe is considering you, they're at a wirehouse, they don't have the same sort of entanglements that you described. You've described one of the ways you've sort of edited your business model to ensure that there aren't the sort of conflicts that they would face at these other firms. Maybe can you delineate some of the other important differences that, you know, a prospective client would hear when you're trying to pitch your services to them, things that, you know, you could affirmatively do for them that perhaps they, a service that they wouldn't receive or wouldn't receive in the same way at a big wirehouse firm?
So I think the main thing that we're trying to do, so I, as a broker, the way I was trained, and I doubt it's much different now, we were trained to find a lid for every pot. So if you had a client come in and say, you know, I read this thing in Barron's about international small caps, and they made the case for it. I want international small caps. Like, if you were a broker, and I was, like, your job was not to holistically have a whole conversation about portfolio construct. You just say, all right, I'll get you a great fund. And then you would go to the approved list of funds that have bought shelf space at your firm that you can recommend and get paid for. And you would find one that's got a selling concession or B shares. That's, you know, you would find the fund that you want to sell and how you're going to get paid on it. And you'd call the client back and you would say, hey, I have the right lid for your pot. I have the right solution for that. I'm not saying like that's criminal or it's so terrible. I'm just saying, like, you never told the client no. You never told the client, I don't have a solution for that. And that's that business. And it's, you know, it's been that way for decades. I wasn't the first to do that. I wasn't the last to do that. I think most RIAs now, especially the successful ones, they're not entertaining those conversations. What they're basically saying is, look, we're going to build a financial plan. You're going to tell us the things that are important to you in life. You're going to explain to us what you really want to use this money for. You might not even know the answer. We're going to have the conversations that help you arrive at the answer. My firm mostly has certified financial planners on the front line doing this work, by the way. Not asset management geniuses, you know, financial planning geniuses, which I think is more helpful to the client. But we're going to figure out what we're trying to accomplish with the money and when, and then we're going to incorporate things like, what's your tax rate? What's the expected inflation rate? What are some of the variables? You might sell your business. You might buy someone else's business. What's your real estate situation? Are you insured properly? And once we arrive at what we're trying to do with the client's assets, then we're recommending a portfolio that we think, I hate the word optimal because it's BS, but we think gives us an optimal chance at success, and then try to build something that's durable so that if and when things change, we can react in both the plan and the portfolio. And so then when a client comes back and says, I want to buy pot stocks or I want to get on this blockchain thing, look, you can do whatever you want. It's your money. But A, we're not going to recommend things to you in that vein. You're going to have to do that on your own. You could do that in a side account. We don't want to get paid on it because it's not part of our advice. And here's the size in which you can do that kind of speculation and it won't throw off your financial plan. So we do have clients who keep a side account to scratch the itch. You know, an IPO comes along, they want to get in on it or whatever. It's not puritanical. We're not saying, no, you can't do things that you want to do. We're just saying before you do something, let's look at how it might affect your future plans and let's do it in a way that I'm not getting paid for giving you advice that I don't believe in. So I think that's a major difference. And it feels good doing things that way, saying no to clients, talking people out of mistakes, or if they're going to do something that you feel is more speculative than what they need, taking a step out of the equation rather than saying, ooh, let me get in on this. you know, the client wants to make a venture investment. Let me see how I can get paid on that. You know, we're not doing any of that kind of work. And it feels good because I know we're not qualified to do it. We shouldn't be doing it. And frankly, for most people, it's recreation. It's not a necessity. They don't need to do these things.
You have such a public presence, as do other people within the firm, and we want to talk more about that. But my question is, do you have clients, prospective clients, who come to you and say, I want that person? And then sometimes there's a little bit of a mismatch that you're not actually doing that planning work or whatever it is. Do you sometimes encounter that where someone has really anchored on, I want that individual?
Christine, that's such a great question. We feel very strongly that financial planning is the highest calling within our profession. And so we will not invest for a client until they've done a financial plan. Like, it's not debatable. That's just the way it works. You've got to go through this process with us. It takes 3 to 4 either phone calls or meetings or both in order to get through to the point where we're making a portfolio recommendation. And that's a lot of work that we're investing up front. And a lot of people in the industry would be like, how can you afford to spend that much time with somebody who's not even paying you? We've got a unique situation. The people coming to us are more than likely going to become clients if we want them and they want what we actually do. They're fans. So we've built it so that we can afford to take that risk and have a CFP spend 3 phone calls, 4 phone calls, 2 meetings and a phone call, whatever it is. We can afford it because the ratio of people who come to us to people who become clients is very high. We're also very discerning up front. So if someone comes and says, I saw Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg TV and I want him to tell me what the market's going to do in 6 months, we're very, very clear with the client that you will be very disappointed with us if that's your expectation. So that financial planning process up front, so much work goes into it, almost because it's like a sieve, and we're weeding people out who would not be happy clients of the firm, because they've got a mismatch in their expectations. Now, what happens more recently is we'll get someone who says, I'm a huge Michael Batnick fan. Well, that's great. Michael Batnick is the director of research. He designs all the portfolios with the committee. So while you're not going to have a face-to-face relationship with him, you're going to be working with a financial planner, but the portfolio you end up in is going to be crafted by Michael and overseen by Michael. And by the way, Ben Carlson and Barry. So that's the way that we're able to I think meet those expectations. And now we've got this other phenomenon with people like Blair Duquesne. Blair is a superstar. She's got her own blog. She's attending conferences and speaking at events. And she's, you know, she had an op-ed in the New York Times the other day, which was bananas. And the phones lit up and people want Blair. The good news is Blair is client-facing. In addition to being a chartered financial analyst, she's also a CFP and she works directly with clients. So sometimes we can make that match perfectly exactly what the client wants. But most of the time we have to explain to people that this is an ensemble. It's a team approach. I've got people that are centrally trading all the accounts. I've got people who are doing all the research. And then I've got people who are client facing and relaying research directly to clients. And if you come aboard my firm, you're getting an entire team working with you in addition to the person that's facing you. And we built it that way on purpose. We compensate employees within the firm that way as a team. Everyone benefits from what the team does, not just from their own work. And by the way, I think that's another key differentiator between an RIA like ours and a wirehouse. At a wirehouse, it's eat what you kill. So yeah, they have research people, et cetera, but you know, it's a payout. It's like, I brought in $1 million account, $1 million account generated $10,000 in fees this year. My payout is 50%, I get 5. And then the other 5 goes to shareholders of the firm. And executive management. We've built this so that as the firm grows, everybody makes more money. And I think as a result of that, we have a lot of cooperation internally. We have a lot of good vibes. When one person's having a lot of success, like Blair, the other advisors are equally happy for her because it's benefiting the whole team. By the way, I know I'm giving you these like 5-minute answers. Am I screwing
up? No worries.
No, this is good.
All right. Go ahead.
Yeah. So I was going to, when you add an advisor to the fold, or maybe you open a new geography, I'm sure everyone you've added is a very skilled practitioner, but not all of them seem to be cut from the same mold. You know, some of them, as you mentioned, are very public-facing or very client-facing, and others may be cut more in the mold of a traditional advisor or financial planner. So what's sort of the calculus or blueprint you follow when you think about how it is you want to add new personnel to the firm and expand?
That's a great question. And I think like in the olden days, the way brokerage firms thought about expansion is they would pick a city or an area of the country that had a lot of old people with a lot of money. And they would say, well, what's the nicest office building downtown in Palm Springs? And we're going to open there. Is there a Starbucks? Fantastic. That's our new branch. And then the advertising would do the trick. And lo and behold, they would have a practice. And that's great. In 2019, I don't think where you work is as important as who you are. So we opened the branch in Lafayette, Louisiana last week. We opened in Charlotte 6 weeks ago. We did not say we need to be in Charlotte. We did not say we need to be in Lafayette, Louisiana. We said, who are these people that are coming to us and looking to join our team? Do we like them or not? And it's not even, do we like them? It's, is their practice a fit? Could they convert their accounts to our portfolios? Do their clients want financial planning? Like, that's the calculus, Jeff. We are hiring the people. You know, Barry and I don't spread out a map like Napoleon and start sticking thumbtacks in it. So here's what's cool about that. Number one, everyone that we've hired has come to us. I never ran a LinkedIn ad. I never used ZipRecruiter. Like I'm lucky in that a lot of the readers of Mike's blog, Ben's blog, Barry's stuff, my stuff, they work in the industry. That, you know, and they will usually, it goes something like this: send an email, say, you know, they'll send it to info@RedHoltzWealth, and they'll say, I'm a huge fan of blank, or all of you guys, or your message, or your content, or whatever it is. And I send it to my clients all the time. And then I thought, why don't I just come join the team? So that's where it usually starts. The first conversation is usually going to happen with Chris Venn, who's a partner here at the firm, one of the founders. He's the director of wealth management, and he is very good at finding out exactly how an advisor runs their business. And he will say to somebody halfway through a conversation, he will say, look, before we spend any more time, this probably isn't going to work. You won't be happy here based on what you're telling me you're looking for, or based on your beliefs about, you know, caring for clients, et cetera. So we'll weed a lot of people out early. If somebody seems like they could be a good fit, the next conversation they're going to have from there is with our CFO, and that'll be a financial conversation, compensation, how we pay people, how our program works, you know, how they make money in their first year, how they ultimately can put themselves in a position to be part of that profit sharing pool that I talked about. And then finally, if they're here for enough time and we deem them, you know, worthy of buying equity, how the pathway to equity works. And if that call goes well and we get a sense of, all right, this is what we would have to pay this person, this is how they build their clients, et cetera, then they have to hit the, I don't know if I can curse on this podcast, the BS detector, which is BATNIC. And they have to get through a conversation with Michael. And Michael is like, just his personality and the way he carries himself, he doesn't do flowery language. And, you know, he says exactly what he thinks. And he asks very direct questions that maybe other people might be nervous about asking. And based on the answers to those questions, Mike will say, I bless this guy or girl. He or she is one of us. Or, I don't know if this is for us. So that process happens, and that takes place over weeks. We're never in a rush. And if somebody comes to us in a rush, it's probably a bad situation. We don't want anything to do with it. So the final phase of that is they've spoken with Chris about how we take care of clients. They've spoken with the CFO, Bill Sweet, about how they can get compensated. They've spoken with Michael, and Michael says, yes, this would be additive to our culture and wouldn't ruin the culture to bring this person in. The next phase is they come to New York, they meet with Barry and I, they spend time with the team, they get a sense of how we do what we do. And then at that point, if it's somebody that should be here, usually it happens. I think we're 31 people now. So that's how it works. It's not a mystery. We don't beat anyone in like a gang. We don't send anyone golden tickets like Willy Wonka. But I think the people who come here are lucky. I mean, of course, I believe that. I think they put themselves immediately as part of a team that is doing incredible things. And, you know, we've grown 10x in 6 years. So they want to be part of that. They want to be with a team that seems to be on the cutting edge. And that's what we think we are. And that's what we're trying to be. So that's how a bill becomes a law.
Can you talk about the principles that you believe in? I think some of them have come out already. You've talked about how you're not short term, but let's talk about whether there's a set of best advice and investing practices that you've enshrined at the firm and that you use to guide each relationship or engagement that you enter into.
So we're big on day trading and weekly option crypto. And look, everyone says the same thing as an answer to this question. We're long term. We believe in value and we believe in prudent decision making. A lot of that is just like boilerplate. I think we're more specific. We say less is more. There's no liquid alts. Just don't do it. I don't have a problem with it. And we might change our mind about that someday. I just don't think it's necessary. There's no hedging. Like the perfect hedge has existed all along. If you're so worried about your equity exposure and the potential for drawdown, which you should be, especially if you're close to retirement and you can't replace that. If you're like so worried about it, then just have more cash or have more short-term treasuries. Like you don't need to be, I have these conversations with people like, oh, I'm fully hedged. Really? So you have a checking account? Like what are you doing? What is the point of taking a $1 million portfolio and hedging it so it can't ever lose any money? You will never make any money. And every time we learn about somebody who's invented some trick to do that, it's either a Ponzi or it's an options overlay strategy that's blowing up, or it's somebody that goes 10 years, never sees any upside. And then they're like, wait a minute, I was hedged, but I wasn't long anything either. So like we talk about that and I'm using generalities. I'm not using data right now, but we write 1,000 blog posts a year on this topic. Like we think that risk assets should be risky and we think that portfolios should be constructed with the possibility of drawdowns already planned for in advance. And we believe that there's room for both strategic and tactical. We don't think that a typical investor, especially an advised investor, can actually go through 2008 with nothing offsetting the downside in markets. So we've got tactical alongside strategic. We want to deliver things in as low cost a way as possible. We focus on the tax ramifications of what we're doing for people. I mentioned Bill Sweet earlier in the conversation. Before we're allocating large accounts, Bill is speaking with the client, getting a sense of what their tax situation is, oftentimes finding things that their accountant isn't even aware of. So we're trying to be fiduciary in the sense of taking a holistic look at the client's total situation. But then when we build portfolios, we tell people, you're going to lose money. It's going to happen. There's no way around it. You will absolutely be in a drawdown. And I think like just being honest about things like that and being fully transparent on our investment beliefs. And then when we say less is more, really meaning it. And when we say long-term, really meaning it. I do think that sets us apart. So everyone in the industry can make these claims, but we are so public that we have to actually deliver on them.
You mentioned tactical before. Is the goal for you and your clients, is it investment alpha or behavioral alpha? And more generally, how do you goal set with clients when you're sitting down and trying to execute a plan for them?
Yeah. So we don't believe in investment alpha using tactical. It's not that you can't do it over a certain period of time. It's that over 30 years, it's very hard to have a strategy that buys and sells the market and beats just holding. So however, as I said earlier, I don't believe that a majority of people can watch their life savings go through a 38% drawdown, which is what a 60-40 portfolio went through in 08, or can watch the NASDAQ go from 5,000 to 900, which is what we saw at the beginning of my career in 2000 to 2002. Like I've dealt with enough people, I've had enough conversations, and I've seen enough to know that that's not appropriate either. It's just telling people, don't worry about it, do nothing, everything will be fine. When they're in their 60s and 70s and they're not going to continue to earn money and put more money into the market. Like when you're at the point where what you have is what you have, I really don't think you can live through that. Now, we're not one of these firms that are out there predicting that is about to happen all the time. In fact, we're the opposite. We talk about how rare it is to have a period like that. But that's not what people want to hear when you actually encounter one. And then there's also sequence of returns risk. So you might have a 20-year bull market where the worst pullback is 20%, which is the 82 to 99 phenomenon. And then all of a sudden it gets cut in half in 6 months. Like that could happen to you. So you can invest and be calm for 20 years and that can happen in the 21st year. And that 21st year might be the year where you were about to pay for someone's wedding or retire. So that's why we have tactical. It's not a huge part of our portfolios. And the term behavioral alpha is cute. I don't know if it's like reality. I think what we're really trying to do is behavioral management. And so we had to design a strategy because it didn't exist that would react very infrequently. So here's my take on like my quick, can I do this? Like my quick one on tactic. Okay. Michael and I took like 100 meetings. We met with every tactical separate account manager, mutual fund, et cetera, et cetera. We know them all. We saw them all. What they all have in common is they're run by a former hedge fund guy, or they're run by somebody that used to be a trader. And the commonality is they all want to trade. Like that's why they gravitated toward running a tactical strategy to begin with. They're not like passive people that found themselves all of a sudden running a tactical model. So when you look at how they actually do what they do, there's a lot of activity. From a wealth management and fiduciary perspective, a lot of activity is the enemy of the end client. It's going to run up a tax bill. It's going to run up trading commissions. It's going to increase the opportunity for somebody to feel like it's not working. Like, why'd you just sell? Wait, why did you just buy? So we wanted to cut down on that. So we had to build our own. It didn't exist. The last straw was we met with a manager. I'm not gonna say who. Billions of dollars, separate accounts for RIAs. The kid comes in here. He's like a wholesaler. He's not the PM, and he's like, we're all technical analysis and quant, and there are 19 signals. So we're looking through it, and then I swear this is true. He looks me in the eyes and whispers. Mike sitting next to me says, "But if something's going on in the market, we could totally get in there and do what we have to do." So he's like rules based, but so we just like we had enough. So Michael took upon himself this massive research project, and we started with the opposite question. We said, "What if you had a tactical model that almost never did anything? What would that look like? How would you do that? What would be the rules?" So we don't want to run up tax bills for clients. We don't want to look like we're these gallant knights charging back and forth across the battlefield and cutting people's heads off. We're not former hedge fund people. So we wanted to have a non-BS tactical solution that we could run alongside the strategic model, which would keep people calm in the event of a prolonged true market downturn. So one of the tricks of that is figuring out, well, how do we distinguish between an actual bear market or downturn versus a correction? I wish I could tell you it's easy. I wish I could tell you we could do that with certainty. We can't. So then the question becomes, well, what happens if you do mistake a downturn for a correction? What's the damage of that? Because, of course, there's downside in anything that you try to do. So we put together back tests. We put together a strategy that we think is the right approach to tactical. It's internal. It's not an ETF. We don't market it. We almost never talk about it. And one of the funniest things that we ever did as a research project is Michael said, what happens if you add 2 and 20 onto this? And you wipe out any benefit whatsoever of being tactical when you do that. So that to me, when you think about all the other things that we could be doing, like hedge funds or options overlay strategies, et cetera, when you add real costs onto these things and you don't do them as a fiduciary, they either blow up or they have absolutely no value when all is said and done. So that's my rant on tactical. I think it's a critical part of what we do, considering how much time we spend talking about behavior and how behavior is more important than what you own.
So has it come up over the past long-running bull market where that tactical strategy has come into action, where you've said, okay, we're entering some sort of what we think will be a prolonged weak market, like maybe the fourth quarter of 2018, for example?
So that's a great question. We don't say that out loud because we don't manage that way. We don't say what we think will be a prolonged bit. Our opinions are irrelevant. It's rules-based. It's on price. So like there's a million other things that you could make decisions on, from economic data to sentiment to market commentary, God forbid. Like there's a million things that you can use as your reasons to buy and sell. But if the only thing that matters is price, I think that's where you have to start and end. So price is what the signals are made of. And so we never make that statement. We think this could be a who cares what we think? My gut instincts are terrible. I have absolutely no opinion that I would ever charge money for or impose on any of our strategies. So when we say the words rules-based, it's not rules-based, but I have a hunch. Or rules-based, but this feels a little bit different and we didn't envision it. We're just not going to do it. So that's the way it works. And again, it's not an alpha strategy. I hope it underperforms because most of our clients' money is not invested in tactical. Most is in strategic asset allocation. It's in stocks, it's in bonds, it's international, it's treasuries, it's corporates, it's REITs. I would rather that do better, quite frankly. And again, we're not a 2-in-20 shop and we're not marketing this externally. So, you know, there's no glory. And if tactical is quote unquote doing well or working, that means you got big problems in the market.
So how do you put together the strategic piece if somebody were to come to you and just casually, perhaps at a little league game, and say, I'm trying to put together a portfolio, I just want the basic building blocks, what's a good way for me to form expectations and maybe choose some of the different asset classes or types of investments that belong in my portfolio? How would you advise them and how does that express itself in the way you advise your clients?
Yeah, we're model portfolios. We don't have one-offs. Look, every client is so different, but their needs are not. Like, people fit very well into models. So I know a lot of people like, oh, we do custom bespoke portfolio. Really, do you? For hundreds of people? Why? Right? So everyone's very different in terms of how they react to the market and how greedy they are, how fearful they are. Some people oscillate wildly back and forth between those two extremes. And everyone's got different hopes and dreams for how they're going to spend the money in their life. Everything from, I really want to take care of my kids and grandkids to, I really want to spend this down and do a lot of traveling. And we've seen it all. But the portfolio returns that are necessary for those things fit into just a few categories. So we're model-based. We're building portfolios that we want them to be as low cost internally as possible. We don't want to rebalance more than twice a year. When we do a reconstitution, meaning pulling out one thing and exchanging it for another, we want that process to be glacial. Like, we're not trying to excite people with asset allocation, and we're not trying to tell people we've invented a new mousetrap. I think our portfolio is great. I think it's among the best that I've seen out there. But of course, I would say that. So the proof that we believe that is the exact same strategies that we recommend to clients, the strategic models, whether they're for more conservative clients or clients who can take a little bit more risk or clients who want a lot of risk, those exact same models are the ones that our employees invest in their own 401ks. We've replicated those models on the 401k platform and it's the same thing. So we're eating our own cooking internally, which I think is really important.
How about asset class return forecasts? If you're doing financial plans and doing asset allocation, you have to have some expectation about sort of long run return expectations for the major asset classes. How do you do it?
Like everyone else, we're using history as our guide. And, you know, certainly using modern financial planning software, there are a lot of different inputs. There are a lot of different ways that you can take things like valuations and you can take prevailing interest rates and you can be maybe too clever. I think we're trying to keep that part of it simple and be very honest that we don't have a good grasp on how you would go about formulating a forecast if you weren't using historical data. Now, that's not to say that people shouldn't try. And I know a lot of Wall Street is people trying to come up with, you know, how an asset might deviate in the future from what it's done in the past. And I have all these pet theories about these things. But at the end of the day, you want to be wrong in such a way that it's not going to be catastrophic for the end client. So even if you just start with baseline assumptions about different asset classes, if you're making small moves, meaning if you're not saying this is the time to go heavily overweight stocks, and now this is the time to go heavily overweight bonds, if you're doing stuff like that, you're opening your client up to potential for catastrophic miscalculation. So we're not doing any of that kind of thing. And I'm sure there are firms that are, and maybe they're really good at it. I've yet to meet anyone that I would have confidence that they'd be able to do that. So we're not attempting it.
I think you gave an example before of, you know, editing you do. You said no liquid alts. I would imagine that could apply to a great many other types of strategies.
No commodity, no gold.
Yeah. What's an example of something that perhaps wouldn't be run-of-the-mill that you have found that there's some utility for certain types of clients and that, you know, wouldn't be a garden variety type of investment to make that perhaps you would see in some other places? Are there some examples that come to mind?
Yeah. So one of the challenges of running a wealth management firm as opposed to running a mutual fund or running a hedge fund or a self-contained strategy is that you're dealing with regular people and they have assets already. And so when you're building financial plans and portfolios for people, you have to account for things that are already in their lives. And so, you know, a lot of the time it's real estate, right? But sometimes it's a client that works at a software company and was employee number four. And now they have a huge amount of their net worth tied up in one stock of one company. And maybe lately that's been great because, you know, we all know software stocks just go up every day and it doesn't matter valuation or anything. But like that won't always be the case. And we've got to A, account for that exposure and build our portfolio around that and sometimes do things that are one-off within the models to account for that. And then B, we have to think about what that might mean for the person's future and what are the potential paths that that asset they hold might take. So that's an example of, I forget what his name is, the gentleman who runs the RIA side of Pershing. He's got this phrase that I've heard him use at conferences. He says, standardize the process, personalize the advice. So we're using models and we've got a standard program that people have to go through in order to have the privilege of becoming customers here. But then you've got a human being with their own issues as your client. Some of them might be prone to needing to pull out cash in emergencies all the time. And so we've got to build portfolios, use models, try to give people as close to the model returns as possible, but then deal with cashiering activity and all these other things that come up. And we've also got to build around the assets people come to us with. So that's one example. And then there are just some things that we're not going to do. So we're not doing non-traded assets. We don't think we have an edge there. I could get in on any deal I want. Like I know a lot of people and I could, if I wanted to, I could start a venture sleeve and start putting people into startups. I have personal investments in startups, but I don't feel that we have the expertise. And by the way, I don't think anyone else does either, but that's another conversation. So we're not doing it. And we have people ask us for it. You just say, look, that's not what we do. We're trying to get you from point A to point Z and avoid all the pitfalls between here and there. We're not stopping people from doing it on their own, but we just don't do it. So we're not doing non-traded real estate investment, you know, direct real estate. We're not doing opportunity zones. We don't think commodities belong in an asset allocation model for a lot of reasons we can get into if you want. So we don't have a, quote, gold sleeve. You know, I talk to all these advisors like, oh, I always allocate 3% to gold. Okay, why? I don't know. Makes the client feel better. I don't know. So like, let's say the world comes to an end, but their gold sleeve goes from being 3% to 4% of their portfolio, goes up 20%. Like, that's, what is that going to do? I don't know. Okay. So we're not doing stuff like that. And I got to tell you, the longer I'm doing this, the more stuff I want to take out, not add. Like, I'm not one of these people that goes to a conference or watches a TV segment and is like, oh, I got to get in on that. Where could that fit in my asset allocation? I'm the opposite. I'm always thinking about how can we simplify this stuff personally. And so the investment committee operates in much the same fashion.
So advice fees are under scrutiny and your model is to charge clients a percentage of their assets that you advise on. Have you experimented or debated other fee models?
You know, we're doing a conference in September called Wealth Stack. It's about the future of financial advice. And we're doing several segments on this concept of, are accounts going to be billed differently in the future, or are people going to want to work with an advisor in a different capacity? I have an open mind. I don't have the fee compression issue. I think we're on the low end of what many firms charge. I think when somebody comes over here from a wirehouse, we're almost always giving them a better deal, in addition to better service, in my opinion, and better portfolio, in my opinion. But we're not one of these firms that's at the high end. And honestly, our clients are here because they want us. Like, it's not like we're some generic registered investment advisory that happens to be down the street in the strip mall next to JCPenney or whatever. Like, that people have sought us out and they've come to us for us. And so they're happy to pay what we charge. And if that radically changes and all of a sudden people don't want us anymore, or people don't feel like they're getting good value for what they're paying us, then we may have to look at that. But at the current moment, like, it's literally not been an issue. We've not lost potential clients over fees because I think for what we're charging and what we're giving people, they like it. They're happy. And so, like, I'm not in a rush to try to reinvent something that's already going well. You know, I have an open mind. I read everybody's stuff. I read Kitz's stuff and, you know, I'm reading all the articles you guys do and we'll see what happens. But for right now, things are going great and clients are happy. And let's hope we can keep everyone happy and adapt if and when we need to.
So I guess a related question, though, is you talked about how a financial plan is so foundational. And so that makes me think, is the AUM way of charging the right way to charge if financial planning is such a big piece of what you're doing and what people are getting? I mean, what do you think of that?
I've already destroyed that argument so many times in print. It's so stupid. I hear it all the time. It's like people don't understand that at the end of the day, the client is judging you on how the portfolio does. Like that is what, like do all these surveys, oh, client, what's most important thing to clients? So it's the relationship. It says, no, it's not. It's a lie. What everyone really looks at is how much money did I make? And you lose clients, not because you have a drawdown or because you underperform, because relative to the expectations you've set, you fail. That's why people move their accounts away from advisors. Anyone can say whatever they want. They're lying if they disagree with that. Anyone that's been in this business for long enough knows that at the end of the day, clients judge advisors on performance. So if you're being judged on that, you may as well get paid for that. And the financial plan is how you figure out the portfolio. And it's the thing that you're talking about with clients the most throughout the course of the year. It's the thing that you're pointing to when clients are nervous or the opposite. They're starting to feel greedy. Why don't I have more tech stocks? Right? So you're using the financial plan to bring them back to earth. And that's a lot of the value prop. But at the end of the day, everyone gets judged on how they've done. And there's really no way around it. Now, in the old days, it used to be, oh, I do financial planning. They would literally sell you a financial plan for $5,000 and they would hand you a binder. And then they would say, if you want, I'm a broker. I can make the trades for you, or you could take it anywhere. And then you would walk out of someone's office, usually an accountant, and you would say, well, I have this binder, I guess my financial plan, that's not worth anything. It's worth nothing. So true financial planning and the portfolio work in tandem with each other. They're hand in hand. And there's a reason why the industry bills the way it does. There's a reason why clients pay the way they do. It may change. I'm open to change. I love change. But you're being judged on the portfolio. You should get paid on the portfolio you recommend. You have to stand by that portfolio more than you have to stand by the financial plan, especially in a tough market environment.
Shifting our gaze forward for a minute, knowing that you and your partners, you like to experiment, innovate, I should say, what do you imagine will be the most visible differences in the way your firm operates and serves clients in, say, 5 or 10 years compared to today? What would we notice is different?
You're saying like in the future?
Exactly.
Well, I think we've done a pretty good job at finding really good advisors all over the country, and you'll see us continue to do that. And I took my kids to Hershey Park a couple years ago, and the night before, rather than go to the park, we went to the Hershey Museum. And Milton Hershey didn't start out as a chocolatier. He tried a couple of other things first. But when he finally struck it and found success was that he figured out that what people wanted was consistency. So the thing with chocolate in those days, 100 years ago, was that the bean would come from a different part of the world throughout the course of the year because the bean was in season. So sometimes it was Latin America and sometimes it was Africa. And so they would constantly source beans from different places and you would have a radically different product throughout the year. And different chocolate makers bought different beans at different times. So everyone had a different experience whenever they ate a candy bar or whatever they were eating. And what Milton Hershey figured out was a way to do all the buying of all the ingredients throughout the year, but then blend them in a specific formula so that anytime you had a Hershey bar, anywhere in the country that you were, and then eventually the world, you always had the same exact mix. You always had the same product. That consistency, I think, whether we make it or not, like that's going to be the deciding factor. When you walk into a Merrill Lynch branch, and I'm not picking on Merrill, it's just the way the industry has always been. You walk into a Merrill Lynch branch and you say, I have $2 million. I was managing it myself. Now I'm getting close to retirement. I need help. You could get a guy that's like his whole deal is MLPs. Like if you walk into a branch in Dallas, Merrill Lynch branch, like you could end up with like a portfolio of like oil and gas limited partnerships and all this stuff. If you walked into an identical looking Merrill Lynch branch in Detroit, Michigan, or in downtown Manhattan, or in West Palm Beach, you might get a totally different portfolio, but you're the same person. what the hell is that? How could that make any sense? So you've got these rep as PM situations all over the country, thousands and thousands of financial advisors who are acting as their own PMs and coming up with their own recipes and making their own portfolios for each client, and every portfolio looks different. We want to be the opposite of that. So we build models, or we bring in a very, very small group of outside managers with strategies that we can't do in-house. And we want the financial planning system to be identical, whether you're talking to Blair in New Orleans, or you're talking to Paul in North Carolina, or you're working with Dan down in Florida, or any of our people. We want them to have the same consistent experience. We don't want a million different things going on in all these different portfolios. So I think if you look at us in 10 years and we've really been successful, it will be because we delivered that. We delivered that consistent experience a la Milton Hershey, and anyone working with Ritholtz Wealth is getting that consistent service and advice, even though the person giving it to them is going to be a different person. You know, again, getting back to standardize the process, personalize the advice.
So on that high note, I think we'll conclude. Josh, it's been a real pleasure talking to you today. Thanks so much for your time and insights and for coming in the long view.
I didn't love all those answers. You want to just do it one more time?
Thanks so much, Josh. You were great.
You guys are great. Thank you for having me.
Take care. Have a good day.
All right, bye.
Thanks for joining us on The Long View. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe to and rate The Long View from Morningstar on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow us on Twitter at Christine_Benz.
And at SYouth1, which is SYOUTH and the number one.
Finally, we'd love to get your feedback. If you have a comment or a guest idea, please email us at thelongview@morningstar.com. Until next time, thanks for joining us.
This recording is for informational purposes only and should not be considered investment advice. Opinions expressed are as of the date of recording. Such opinions are subject to change. The views and opinions of guests on this program are not necessarily those of Morningstar Inc. and its affiliates. Morningstar and its affiliates are not affiliated with this guest or his or her business affiliates unless otherwise stated. Morningstar does not guarantee the accuracy or the completeness of the data presented herein. Jeff Batak is an employee of Morningstar Research Services, LLC. Morningstar Research Services is a subsidiary of Morningstar Inc. and is registered with and governed by the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Morningstar Research Services shall not be responsible for any trading decisions, damages, or other losses resulting from or related to the information, data analyses, or opinions, or their use. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results. All investments are subject to investment risk, including possible loss of principal. Individuals should seriously consider if an investment is suitable for them by referencing their own financial position, investment objectives, and risk profile before making any investment decision.